a leadership conference for high school girls and adult advocates for girls. The conference includes a private documentary screening and several leadership tracks for girls and women. This event takes place at the Mexican Heritage Plaza, 1700 Alum Rock Avenue, San Jose. For details, call 408-299-5152. The community calendar is produced by members of the First Voice Apprenticeship Program. Send your listing at least 4 weeks in advance to KPFA, Box 51, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley, California, 94704. Or email us at calendar@kpfa.org. Tell us if your event is wheelchair accessible. To hear this calendar again, call 510-848-6767, extension 621. This calendar is also online at kpfa.org.
يا جماعة المسلمين والمسلمات of Africa الحمد لله تعالى الله واحد.
The time here at radio stations KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, and KFCF coming out of Fresno. It's 88.1 out of Fresno, and all the time online at www.kpfa.org. It's 7:01, and it's time for Africa Today with your regular host, Walter Turner. In the background, the sounds of Askiba Modibo from Mali.
Salamu alaikum.
Yeah, coming up on Sunday, March 1st, from 3 to 5 p.m., that's going to be at the Humanist Hall, 390 27th Street in Oakland, Haiti, Resistance and Solidarity, featuring Pierre Labossiere, the Haiti Action Committee, Laura Kinswani of the Arab Resource Center, Sonika Bryant of Malcolm X Grassroots, and Devontae Jackson of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, the 11th anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup that overthrew democracy in Haiti. That's going to be coming up on Sunday, March 1st, from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Humanist Hall. That's 390 27th Street in Oakland. You can always take a look at the www.haitisolidarity.net if you want more information. Great event keeping us in touch with developments in Haiti. Well, we start off this evening talking about the case of the Angola 3 and Albert Woodfox with representatives of the Angola 3 Committee and Amnesty International. Case you should know about. Be engaged. The Angola Three are three men, Robert Hillary King, Albert Woodfox, and Herman Wallace, who were incarcerated in solitary confinement at Angola Prison in Louisiana. They went to the prison in the early 1970s. Robert King was released in 2001. Herman Wallace was finally released in 2013, lived just a few days. The remaining member of the Angola 3, Albert Woodfox, has had his conviction overturned three times as Albert Woodfox and still remains incarcerated. The court rulings have been fairly clear on the unconstitutionality of the way the juries were picked and chosen. Amnesty International, along with the Angola 3 Committee and supporters around the world, have launched a petition to demand that Albert Woodfox be released on bail and that the legal decisions overturning his conviction be honored. We are joined on the phone by Jasmine Heiss. She is a senior campaigner at Amnesty International U.S., a campaigner on the program with individuals and communities at risk. We spoke with her a while ago about Ferguson. And Robert Free King, he's one of the Angola Three. He was released in 2001. He served 29 years in solitary confinement. author from the bottom of the heap. He's been traveling around the world raising consciousness on the issue of the Angola 3, slavery, solitary confinement, and torture. Thank you both for joining Africa Today.
Thank you, Ray.
Absolutely.
Give us a brief sketch here. I said a few things of the Angola 3. Who are these three men, Robert, Albert, and Herman? Just a bullet point.
Well, one of these men is on the phone with you today, so I'm going to let him talk a little bit about his experience in the case, Robert.
Well, yes, but what I was about to say was, wow, you can do this also, but I want to give about a good overview as it can be given. I can only go back to reiterate to know we are, Herman Albert and I, you know, we were initially, you know, sent to prison in the early 1970s, and on unrelated charges, and of course, by this time in the early 70s, we were had developed an ideology that was akin to the Black Panther Party, and we ultimately became members of the Black Panther Party. And our record kind of followed us. Herman and Albert's record followed them to prison when they went to Angola. Of course, at the time they were sent in a man prison population. And while in a man prison population, they began to speak out against some of the atrocities that was going on in Angola at the time. They, along with some other people, Ron Ellsworth and a few more people, whose name has, you know, gotten lost in history. But the idea was to kind of clean up, you know, the image of Angola with regards to the prisoners. It was considered the worst prison in the nation at the time. And there were inmate guards who manned the tower, who exercised whatever they wanted. They lorded over the inmate population. They engaged in raping younger inmates, selling younger inmates to older convicts. That was the main crop at the time was sugar cane. And during the harvest, you know, when it rained, especially during the late November, September, October, November, it rains, and guys were working in the field cutting sugar cane, sometimes 17 hours a day without any, you know, the proper clothing on. And Herman and Albert, you know, saw this because the fact that they was, you know, had been sent to prison, they had developed an ideology, okay, the Black Panther Party, one of humanitarianism, and they decided to implement this ideology in prison. They began to teach, you know, the inmates that despite the fact that you are in prison, you have still have constitutional rights, and you have the right to be treated not subhuman, you know, perpetually. And as a result of this, they became targets. Of course, they also were influenced to a lot of other people who came on board. And there were a lot of things that were taking place. This was, you know, during the early 70s, and the stuff that was going on in prison, it was just an enactment of what was taking place in the larger prison, which I considered at the time society. There was, you know, student protesting the wall. There was, you know, all types of stuff that was going on, and as a result of it, there were murders by, you know, National Guardsmen at Kent State, Ohio State, and Southern, and a few other colleges around the country as a result of their protesting. And it was a lot of people were protesting, so this impacted Angola as well. You had Attica had took place, you know, just prior to some of this in September 1971. So in 72, you know, prison was a hotbed of what they call, quote, unrest. But there was a legitimacy about this unrest because people had become politicized, and they had begun to equate prison, modern day prison with slavery. And making this equation, they developed a different concept. So the mentality that may have been, you know, mentality became somewhat, like George pointed out, revolutionary mentality, because they were able to put their issues in context, and Albert and Herman were able to do this, and they you know, begun this campaign to get guys in prison to do the same, and this happened. Sometime later, an officer was found slain in the dormitory, Brent Miller. He was stabbed numerous of times, and the first people, you know, after, you know, intimidation and a lot of things that had, you know, unnecessarily took place among the prison population, the people who were the major suspect in this were members of the Black Panther Party, or people who pledged to be members of the Black Panther Party, or a militant group, as they call it. And Harmon and Albert hated this. So, you know, they had become what you call targets, you know, just by mm-hmm. their way of trying to educate the masses in prison about what was going on, the true nature of prison, and how they could do something to alter or change these conditions or rectify them to some degree. Okay. So they were targets. And when this officer was found slain in the dormitory, the first people they suspect were members of the Black Panther Party and other people who they considered militants. And there were four people indicted initially for this a crime, which was besides Harmon and Albert, besides Harmon Wallace and Albert Woodfox, there was Chester Jackson, and there were also Gilbert Montague as well charged in this. Of course, Gilbert Montague was acquitted on the charge. The officer testified to where he was, and we know what happened with Chester Jackson. He went to trial with Harmon. Albert went to trial and was found guilty and was given a life sentence. And again, like I said, Chester Jackson went to trial with Harmon 6 months later, and Harmon was given a life sentence. And for the reason given in the records, Chester Jackson was given a 21-year sentence to run in with the 75 years that he had gotten. But the point is this, that Harmon and Albert, you know, as a result, over the years, they began to, you know, to not just speak out against what was going on in prison with the condition, but they began to look at their sentences as well. About some time after Harmon was sent to prison and Albert was sent, they also sent me to prison. I think I was sent to prison about 2 weeks after this incident occurred. It occurred in 1972, April, and sometime in some months later, 2 weeks later, so I was sent to prison, and they placed me in solitary confinement. They placed in a place called CCR, or closed cell restriction, which, you know, later became known as solitary confinement. And they had me on an investigation, Walter, for this same particular crime, even though I was 150 miles away, had never been in prison. But I was under investigation for more.
But now let's keep going here. And why does Amnesty become involved in this, Jasmine? I mean, Amnesty is connected with a lot of issues. This might not resonate quickly with the work that people know Amnesty. Why is Amnesty involved in the case of the Angola 3, now essentially the Angola 2, with the death last year of Harmon Wallace?
It's an excellent question, Walter, and it has a lot of answers. I think that most immediately the answer is really looking at Albert's situation now and the history of the case. It's clearly one of injustice compounded. As Robert has gotten into some of the history of the case and these myriad sort of tangled legal details, you know, I think one of the things that is the most clear to me every time I look at this case and when I listen to him is the way in which both the process by which Albert, Harmon, and Robert were placed in solitary confinement and then kept there for decades after all of these unsafe legal processes, after a conviction being overturned 3 times, that is just clearly a violation of some of the due process standards that we look to in the United States as being so core to our justice system. And then on top of that, of course, he has been in solitary confinement for 4 decades in a cell the size of a parking space. It's cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and it is the kind of situation that the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, Juan Mendez, has actually explicitly described as torture. So Albert's case is really an outstanding phenomenon, one that sort of boggles the moral imagination of an even bigger problem in the United States, which is long-term solitary confinement in our prisons. It's estimated that at any time about 80,000 people are being held in some form of isolation. And so in a way, we're really an outlier on the world stage as a country in the way that we treat prisoners and in the kind of conditions that we subject people to. And Albert's case is really emblematic of that, the case of the Angola 3. And as I mentioned before, you know, it's only compounded by the fact that Albert has been kept in solitary confinement for all of this time, and Robert before his release and Harmon before him after a legal process just riddled with flaws.
You know, why, as one reads through this, doing background on this, one can't help but just be seething about what appears to be complete lack of process. Your executive director says it's time for the Attorney General Caldwell of Louisiana to stop standing in the way of justice. Why, after the conviction being overturned three times, is the state of Louisiana still indicting Albert Woodfox, not willing to let him go after what amounts to more than 40 years?
You know, it's an excellent question, and I'm sure Robert has some thoughts on the way in which the Attorney General has continued to pursue what looks like vengeance on this case. We've seen him at every turn appeal the state's rulings. We've seen punitive measures while Aubert has been held inside a solitary confinement facility, things like strip searches every time he leaves his cell. And so it's a question that even I can't answer. Why is the Attorney General, why is the state of Louisiana so committed to keeping this man behind bars, despite the fact that not only has his conviction been overturned three times, but he has a clean disciplinary record? There's no reason for him to continue to be held in solitary. I would just add to that, you know, one of the really troubling things that we've seen from the Attorney General are these ongoing accusations of rape, which are totally unfounded. And they not only trouble us as the human rights community, it's really a question as to whether the Attorney General of Louisiana is abusing professional standards. Again, he's continued every time Albert is taking a step forward in his legal process to bring forward these unfounded accusations of rape, to inflame the public against him. So again, I just echo your question. What is the Attorney General doing? What is he after here, and why does he keep trying to block Albert's release?
Well, how do you answer this, Robert? Because you travel all over the world, Denmark, Canada, Brazil. You've met with Desmond Tutu highlighting this issue. I mean, clearly it has to be seen as a political case. Give us two points here. Why is Albert Woodfox not being released, even though the courts have said he should be released?
Well, I think Buddy Caldwell, the state's attorney general, he has, for some reason, allowed himself to become obsessed with this case. There are probably a number of speculations as to why he persists in pursuing or prosecuting Albert for this case. Yeah, and one is that the history of John Sinkfield, who was a young attorney at the time, became the attorney general some 20 or so, 25 years later. But he was a young green attorney at the time, anxious to get out, to make a name for himself. And John Sinkfield, along with John Pikul, they were the one who prosecuted Albert Woodfox when he was indicted by this West Feliciana grand jury. They engaged in the initial trial. Somewhere along the line, John Sinkfield became, again, the attorney general. He brought in a friend of his, Buddy Caldwell, whom they went to school, and this is open, public records. They went to school from 5 years on up. They went through law school. My belief is just that they have to validate each other in keeping this thing going. In the middle of all of this, there was this other state attorney general in the middle of both Buddy Caldwell and John Sinkfield. Because John Sinkfield could not, it would have been a blatant conflict of interest had he taken the case himself. So he let the case go down to one of his assistants, which was Julie Caldwell. And during the second trial, she elected to retry Albert, and these are her words, as a Black Panther. And I'm sure that she got her teaching, and she got this from John Sinkfield, who had initially prosecuted this case and perhaps would have seen some of his career get blemished as a result of Albert's winning this initial appeal that he had, presided over. And so when Julie Cullen, she went to trial and Albert was found guilty again. But then Buddy Caldwell, he ended up, because he was assistant attorney general as well, and John Sinkfield a partner, and so he ended up with this case, and he has taken up the banner in which his friend Julie Cullen has taken up her battle in which she said she would prosecute Abbott as a Panther, and John Sinkfield, who 25 years earlier said he would be prosecuting Abbott as a Panther. So I imagine to validate both their careers, there is a reason why this thing is perpetual.
Now, you know, there's been attention on the case, but there's not been enough attention on the case, given how you see the world respond to cases of, let me say, editorializing here, of torture and cruel and inhumane punishment. What is Amnesty saying, Jasmine, in terms of why should people go on to the Amnesty site and sign this petition that Albert Woodfox be released, that the bail be honored? You know, why? I mean, what are you saying to people to get them to understand this point from your perspective?
Well, you know, what always comes to mind for me is the famous quote that you can understand the state of society by the way that that society treats its prisoners. I think that when you look at the case of Albert Woodfox, when you look at a country that has held a man in cruel, inhuman, and degrading conditions for 43 years almost. He's been in solitary confinement. He was first placed there in 1972. It's hard for me to understand it in any way besides an indictment on our country and the way that we choose to treat people who are behind bars. Now, when you add to that the fact that Albert has spent 43 years maintaining his innocence and fighting to prove it in this deeply flawed legal process, I think that indictment becomes even more ringing. And so what we say is Albert's rights are human rights. Our work is based on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the idea that all human beings have inherent and fundamental human dignity. It's time for the state of Louisiana to stop keeping this man in cruel isolation, to stop waging an affront on his dignity, and to stop at this point standing in the way of justice, to let the wisdom of what now has been three courts stand, not to oppose bail, and to let Albert walk free.
Okay. Now, there is the Angola 3 Committee, and you can Google that and find that. There is also Amnesty International. What's your website link there, Jasmine?
You can find our website at amnestyusa.org. And to immediately sign on to our petition, which is currently targeted at the governor of Louisiana, Bobby Jindal, asking him to ensure that the state stops standing in the way of justice, you can go to amnestyusa.org/Angola3. I would urge all of your listeners, all of those who are committed to things like racial justice, to equity, to human rights, to add their names to the call today and let Louisiana know this cannot be done any longer. It's time for the governor to ensure that Albert's cruel isolation does not become his legacy.
So this will go to Governor Jindal. It's Amnesty. Give us the website link again, Jasmine.
Absolutely. It's amnestyusa.org/Angola3, A-N-G-O-L-A, the number 3.
You know, King, talking about your friend Herman, I mean, to put it in context, Herman was released in 2003, and as he was dying, he was indicted again. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. We learned that the state of Louisiana, on Buddy Caldwell's part, he decided to reindict Herman again, but like I said then, and like I say now, Walter, that you know Herman case, and it, again, it's a little different from Albert. The judge ordered Herman release, overturned his conviction, and ordered his release from prison that day. So Herman was exonerated when he left prison. Now, the state of Louisiana, of course, Buddy Caldwell did managed to get him reindicted, but I don't believe that were any federal court would have upheld a ruling by any state court with regards to this particular case. Additionally, I don't believe in Albert's case that the same thing will happen in Albert's case under different circumstances, but I don't believe there is any, no matter what information that is placed out there about Albert's so-called past and what he has done in one week, it just won't happen. Albert, a petty jury will not convict or reconvict Albert, and the indictment is not a reconviction. It's not a reinstitution.
Okay. Okay. What can, Jasmine, the average citizen, I mean, clearly the citizenry who hears the program, they can go to amnestyusa.org/Angola3, sign on the petition. What else should people do? Because I noticed that this campaign, I've heard King mention the word torture before, slavery. I've heard you talk about criminal justice, solitary confinement, these whole ideal of Max. Fit that in a larger picture, and why should Citizen A or Citizen B respond?
Well, you know, one of the things that in the face of all of this brutality by the state, in the face of injustice, one of the things that is heartening, I believe, is a change in our country. I believe that there is a change that's happening and that will continue to grow, where people are re-examining the state of solitary confinement in the United States. There's been a questioning of the use of indefinite solitary confinement, I think in large part because people hear stories like Albert's or Herman's, and they're outraged and they're disgusted and they want things to change. So I would encourage people to look at their states, to understand how long-term isolation is used around the country, how it keeps people like Albert behind bars, and see if there are reforms that they can support, see if there's legislation that they can help support. I think that, you know, Amnesty is committed to looking at not only things like long-term solitary confinement and the death penalty, which are really, you know, some of the biggest indicators of the way in which our prison system really devalues human life. We believe that the death penalty is the ultimate denial of human rights. But looking at things like drivers of mass incarceration, okay, what leads to people being behind bars, and we are committed to taking a stand against these things. And we hope that all people who are invested, again, in things like dignity and justice and equity will stand with us.
Now, there's a March 2nd date coming up. Is that correct, Jasmine?
There is. There's a March 2nd date scheduled currently for Albert's bail hearing. Now, of course, in advance of that date, we are calling on the governor and on the Louisiana authorities not to oppose bail. It will be heard by Judge Brady. So if folks would like to take the next step after taking online action, they can pick up the phone today and they can call the governor's office in Louisiana and ask him to see that the state stops standing in the way of justice. They can make sure that Albert's name is being elevated. They can read more, do research, and make sure that, you know, the Louisiana authorities and all those who would further repressive regimes of solitary confinement in this country and around the world know that we won't let people like Albert be forgotten.
Okay, that site again, amnestyusa.org/Angola.
Angola 3, AngolaUSA.org/Angola3.
There is also, if you Google it, there is a blog that comes out that's on the Angola 3. And particularly, King, in our last few moments here, before we double-check and make sure people know that this is urgent, these are your friends. Say something about, because this is what you've done since 2001. Say something about the importance of this, not only because these are your friends, but in the struggle that all of you were working out, working with in the inside Angola.
Well, you know, I think we also along the way we were, you know, began to deem ourselves as political prisoners, but we evolved along the way as well. And Herman Alvin and I, we begin to see our, you know, that we kind of highlighted what was taking place around the country. Of course, the Black Panther Party, so many people had seen it many years earlier, but our evolution caught up with us, and we began to see that this was pervasive and massive, like has been indicated by Jasmine. And so we took a different approach to it, and while we are focus on ourselves, we begin to see the bigger picture. And so this is where our effort was geared toward. And the fact that I was fortunate enough, you know, to get out of prison, and I had a bigger platform to go from, and meeting up with so many lovely people and beautiful people in Amnesty National, International, Amnesty USCN International. I mean, people like that who have embraced the human rights and embraced this case specifically. And so, I mean, it's there's nothing else to do but to continue to fight. So Harmon is gone. Harmon was released. Albert will be out pretty soon, but the struggle continues. You know, it goes on, and it don't stop with Harmon, Albert, nor I. It is not just Angola 3, but it's the American 2 million 3 and so forth and so on.
Okay. We want to thank both Jasmine Heiss of Amnesty International, who is a senior campaigner at Amnesty International working with individuals and communities at risk. Jasmine was part of the Amnesty International USA delegation to Ferguson following the shooting of Michael Brown. We're also joined by Robert King, one of the Angola 3, released in 2001. He's the author of From the Bottom of the Heap, Has Traveled the World, speaking on the case of Angola 3. There are certainly a number of things that you can take a look at, the book by Robert King. There's a film, The House that Herman Built. There is a video in The Land of the Free. The petition is located for Albert Woodfox of the Angola 3 on the Amnesty International page. And one of these times when we talk in the very near future, we'll talk about this whole issue of school-to-prison pipeline and put the issues that both Robert and Jasmine have raised in that context for all of us. But thank you so much. I encourage listeners to move forward on this. Thanks, Jasmine. Thanks, Robert, for being with us.
My absolute pleasure.
You're listening there to the voice of both. You're listening there to the voice of both Jasmine Heiss and Robert King, talking about developments of the Angola 3. Excuse the technical there. You can go online, www.angola3.org or www.amnestyusa.org. This is a case that you should know about and be engaged in, as Jasmine and Robert laid out. Albert Woodfox has been incarcerated in solitary confinement for approximately 40 years, and Amnesty International, as well as people around the world, have taken on the case. His conviction has been overturned on 3 occasions, and you can go and sign a petition on www.amnestyusa.org/Angola3.
Assalamu alaikum. المسلمين والمسلمات of Africa. الحمد لله تعالى. الله واحد.
A Priority Africa Network was formed in 2003 in San Francisco, the Oakland Bay Area, to address the urgent need to prioritize the issue of social and economic justice in Africa. The roots of PAN, as we call it, a Priority Africa Network, go back to many who fought in struggles and organized in the struggles, the anti-apartheid struggles, the activism struggles, Guinea-Bissau and other countries around the African continent. PAN has worked to be a forum for dialogue and discussion by hosting regular events and highlighting the changing importance of African immigrants to the United States and their interactions with African-American communities and Americans in general. Last year, PAN sponsored a number of different events on LGBT TQI communities, South Africa, Ebola awareness, climate justice, etc. And joining Africa today is our pleasure to have Rufaro Garada. She is the new network coordinator of Priority Africa Network. She is from the country of Zimbabwe. She has worked in both the countries of Malawi and studied in the UK. A lot of her emphasis has been on Sub-Sahara, with the emphasis on women and girls' rights, HIV and AIDS. She's used storytelling to mobilize resources. She was previously an interim coordinator for Sub-Saharan program at the Global Fund for Women. She's developed a web content with Africa Speaks for Africa, and she's been a manager for a campaign for female education. She works a lot around issues, drives to work a lot around issues of African philanthropy and also neo-diaspora Africa woman. Rufaro, thanks for joining Africa today.
Thank you for having me.
Good. We want to give a shout out to Nunu Kadani, who was the network coordinator of Priority Africa. You've heard her before, who stepped aside after 11 years. And Nunu is continuing to be out there working on issues of migration and immigration. Rufaro, congratulations on being the new network coordinator of Priority Africa Network.
Thank you so much. Nunu's shoes are quite big to fill, so I'm excited for the adventure, but also know there's a lot to be done.
Okay. Talk about the road that you've taken to be part of Priority Africa Network. Where are some of your interest and roots in the work that you'll be doing with Priority Africa Network, and the work that you've done in Malawi and writing and grants and those type of things?
So I grew up in Zimbabwe, and coming to the U.S., I was just supposed to stay for a little bit, complete school, and go home. But different circumstances caused me to stay here. And as I was trying to figure out my professional path, international development kept coming up for me, particularly my interest in women and girls' rights, women and girls' voices in sub-Saharan Africa. So I think what brought me to PAN is PAN's focus on issues that are important to me, social and economic justice on the continent, but also positive portrayals of Africa and Africans that challenge the different stereotypes that are out there, whether it's the negative stereotypes of poor Africans, diseased, hungry, bad governance, or stereotypes that show us as simply being performers, whether it's dancing or whatever other forms of performance there are out there. So as I've done work at CAMFED, at Global Fund for Women, what kept coming up for me is the sense of how do I give back to my continent and to my country, not only for the education I got as a child growing up, but with what I have now. I'm not living on the continent right now, but how do I give back? And so that's what took me to the roles I ended up taking up. And so when the opportunity opened up at PAN, I felt that it made sense with the trajectory I'd taken thus far.
Okay, well, I've worked with PAN before, and it's wonderful to have you. I've seen you in a couple of the programs. Why the focus on women and girls? Why has that been a focus that you've not just done one or two things about, but it's somewhat been a foundation of what your work has been about, Rufaro?
I think growing up, I do come from a background of relative privilege, but looking around me and seeing some of the negative experiences that women and girls had, whether it's not being able to go to school because parents have to make the difficult economic decisions around who gets to go to school, a son or a daughter, and how does that benefit us in the future. Seeing some other relatives, some female relatives particularly, living with domestic violence. And I mean, luckily some have left, but others haven't. And then I went to an all-girls boarding school. And so sometimes stories were told that got me thinking about, well, what do we do about situations like sexual harassment of students, where the student body is talking about it, but I don't know that school administrators are necessarily acting. And so I'm in my head a lot, and I think because I've been thinking so much about it over the years, when I got the opportunity to continue with my studies and then step into the spaces of women and girls' rights professionally, that's what spurred me on.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a couple of things. One, let's talk a bit. You work for something that people may not be familiar with, and it was called Africa Speaks for Africa, and you were doing some work around the Decade of Women. Talk a bit about that, what that was, what that meant to you, how that helped with your vision of where you want to go.
So Africa Speaks for Africa is an e-zine, I guess, or a zine, primarily has an online presence, working to amplify the voices of Africans in the diaspora and on the continent. For me, working with Africa Speaks for Africa came at a time when I was feeling particularly frustrated by mainstream media portrayals of the continent, and also the voices that purported to speak for Africans or to report on issues happening on the continent. In relation to the piece of privileging African women's voices at AS4A, it is the African Women's Decade, 2010 to 2020. As I was looking for articles to showcase on the site, time and again, most of the voices that came up as the African voices are male voices. And I think that probably comes from perhaps women not really always having the space to express themselves or to comment on political issues, on social issues, on cultural issues in a formal space, in a public space, and in writing. And so that for me was key, to have a separate space on the site called Women's Voices.
Mm-hmm. What are we missing? You having worked with organizations, outstanding organizations like the Global Fund for Women, what are we missing other than not hearing the voices? What part of the story are we not hearing about civil society, about women's organizations on the ground? For example, I spoke with someone a few weeks ago and we were talking about Nigeria and Boko Haram, mm-hmm. which is a story. But their point was that organizing is still going on. This is happening. This is happening. What are we missing, mm-hmm. you from the continent and us here kind of as listeners?
Mm-hmm. I think we, because I live here in the U.S. and have been here for a while, we can easily fall into the trap of always maintaining the story that's been told in the past. And so for me, what actually resonates as I think about what's happening on the ground is that there is a lot going on and mainstream media doesn't always catch it. And so it's important for us to be able to expose ourselves to the individuals and organizations that are doing work on the ground. And there are many different ways to do that. I mean, you mentioned Global Fund for Women. If you just look at their impact page, there is information on incredible work that's being done in many different countries on the continent. I think, you know, just looking on the internet, there's an entity out of Zimbabwe called Her Zimbabwe. These are young women, primarily young women, organizing through written word, talking about issues that impact them every day outside of the stories that mainstream media, especially Western media, would like to carry around, President Mugabe tripped. You know, there is more going on than that.
Okay. We're listening to the voice of Rufaro Gourada. She is the new network coordinator of Priority Africa Network here based in the Bay Area. Priority Africa .org, isn't it correct?
Yes.
Priority Africa. I should know it by now. What does, you know, you mentioned younger voices. You talked about Her Zimbabwe and other Global Fund for Women. What does this space mean to someone like yourself who is of a different generation than the people who were the formulators of PAN? What do you see as add-ons and other pieces that your vision, Rufaro's vision, is about what PAN can do or might do?
So I think the add-ons actually for me, start in the past, or where PAN has been, or where PAN came from. I think the anti-apartheid movement is absolutely important. And as a Zimbabwean of a certain age, I know about that movement because Zimbabwe was a frontline state. For other people outside of southern Africa, so going to the east and further west and north, sometimes the anti-apartheid movement might not seem as present. It might not be a reality that they truly understand. And so I think my generation and those who are younger than I am have the power of social media, of the internet, and the different networking opportunities that there are through those platforms. And then the other thing for me, as I survey the landscape in trying to figure out where I'd like to take PAN, something that's come up time and again is that many of us are straddling spaces where we're absolutely behind Africa's development, led by Africans, but we're also in these spaces like Silicon Valley, where you have a lot of technology-based knowledge and professional experience, and so many people are trying to figure out how do we bring intersections there? How do we make our work outside of a nonprofit sector, if you will, resonate? So I'm enjoying learning about the different entities and groups out there, and also trying to figure out how we harness technology and innovate to take PAN to the next however many years.
Talk more a bit about that, harnessing technology, about getting into those other spaces. You had a program, I think, early in January or last year where you had a representative from South Africa, and that was one of those pieces. But talk about how exciting or how energizing that is, a piece for young people on the African continent now.
So yes, we had Fumani Mtembi from Knowledge Pili, and the title of that event was Innovating for Change in Africa, Forget Development as Usual, because I think a lot of development projects, development programs, it's the usual. Let's go dig wells. Let's go send girls to school, without really digging into other issues that young people are interested in and working on. So in the case of Knowledge Pili, one of their key programs that really spoke to me is this idea that we need to generate our own knowledge and therefore drive our own development by tapping into our mother tongues. And the knowledge that comes from speaking your mother tongue and understanding some of the idioms and nuances that come from your mother tongue. And so I think that's really exciting. And frankly, no Western donor could go tell us how to be in our mother tongues, how to progress, how to develop our communities in the ways that make most sense to us.
That's interesting. The idea of the mother tongue is interesting. This notion, you know, there was something else I saw on your sheet there, and we talked last week. We aired an interview with Wanja of Uhai. Talk about this idea of African philanthropy. I know you worked with Akili Dada, and they did some work, and obviously Uhai East Africa has done work around LGBTQI community. But talk about your vision of African philanthropy. Is this using resources already on the continent? Is this funding organization, institution? How are you looking at the referral?
As you mentioned, Wanda, I have to smile because she shared something. Well, we had a conversation, and I was sharing that sometimes I struggle with the idea of, you know, writing proposals to Western funders to push forward the work happening on the continent because, well, we don't want to have this idea of always having a begging bowl. And Wanja's response was, well, those resources belong to us. That wealth with which all this philanthropic work is being done came from resources that were extracted and continue to be extracted from our continent. And so it's our money. So I actually agree with that. Agree with that. But in terms of African philanthropy itself, many people have spoken about remittances and how Africans send a lot of money home. But we need to move beyond remittances because there are many people who do not benefit from having family outside of the country. And I think once we figure out institutions or ways in which we can support activism and movement building and other such programs happening on the continent, we become the definers of how the work is done and why it's done. And actually, people on the continent, they know what's needed, right? Mm-hmm. I can only support so much being over here and being a spectator in some ways. But I want to be a spectator who can mobilize resources from this end with correct information about the possibilities on the continent and what the real needs are.
Mm-hmm. All that is very interesting. You know, a couple of things are jumping in my mind. One is this, you're talking about development and being able to address the real needs. And by the way, since we're all from Africa, that money also comes us to some of us African Americans here.
Yes.
Everybody's from Africa.
Yes.
But this agenda, looking at Pan-Africanism, using the word in that particular context, the level of clarity among the AU and civil society about women and development, not women as appendages to development, but women as development, that's a key part. Talk about where that's at and your thoughts on that, Rivaro.
Well, women cannot be appendages to development. That's just actually not going to work and doesn't work. Again, going back to my work, say, at Global Fund, some of the proposals I read from grantees or reports from grantees showed that a lot of work that happens actually has to happen sometimes outside of the formal structures of I'll back up and say I think a lot of the work that ends up happening is because the women and girls feel that it has to happen and we're going to make it happen. And so sometimes that'll happen on a shoestring budget or without a budget. And so development as we know it, or development as normally portrayed, I think sometimes does tend to, you know, kind of tack women into it, or actually tends to instrumentalize women. You know, say, well, without development without women doesn't make sense, or something along those mm-hmm. lines. Sense as in C-E-N-T-S.
Okay.
And that's instrumentalizing women. I don't think we should be looked at in those terms. If anything, it should be development with women is what needs to be done, and to stop this idea of commodifying women and saying, well, without women, then we can't achieve whatever economic goals. I think that also for women to really be part of development, there has to be this understanding that we are equal. We're not like men. We are women and we are equal. We are like women.
Okay. Yeah. So you have an event. What's the address of the Priority African Network office? 6501 Telegraph Avenue. That's
yes.
in Oakland.
I transposed my numbers.
That's not good, Rafael.
No, I transposed my numbers. I could see the 6 and the 5 and the 1.
And the 1. So tomorrow there's a program which starts at 5:30, 6501 Telegraph Avenue. Congolese youth leader Ben Kabamba, he's the president of Youth for a New Society. We'll talk about his personal experiences. Ben, he's here in the United States for a UN youth conference. He's going to be joined by Maurice Carney, who we've spoken with before. Maurice is the executive director of Friends of the Congo, and he is visiting the California area. And that's www.priorityafrica.org. And on March 1st, Ben and Maurice will be at the Lafayette Arinda Presbyterian Church. And they'll be speaking about similar issues. And that's one of the events that are coming up. What is the neo-diaspora? What does that mean, Rufaro? I saw that in your notes. What does that mean?
I did not make that term up, just so we're clear.
Okay.
I, I've seen it out and about. I think near diaspora, anyway, what it means to me is, well, neo as in new, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in reference to Africans who have recently come from the continent or who are born to parents who recently came from the continent, we are people who are growing up straddling two worlds for the most part, or we are coming to adulthood in a country or in a space outside of home, as in the continent. And so I think neo-diaspora folks, our experience, our immigrant experience is slightly different from, say, our parents' generation.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of us don't have as close ties to the continent, and yet we still strongly identify as African and from whatever different countries we're from. But we are also living in the U.S. or wherever else in the West and identifying in some ways with that space as well. And so I think neo-diasporans are dual culture people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What does that mean? Does that mean how is that neo-diaspora relationship different in terms of interacting with quote-unquote African-American communities? I mean, the way in which African-Americans see themselves versus the way historically African immigrants have seen themselves, and now we're talking about the neo-diaspora. What's the difference? Is this people like Teju Cole, or is it, how is it? Is it writers? Is it artists? Is it youth? Is it social media? Tell me about that.
Wow, that's a big question. I think you mentioned artists, right? And I think there've been artists from previous generations, but because of social media, because of globalization, and because we are so much more interconnected and have access to different news sources, different information sources, we see and hear more about neo-diasporans because the information is there. And then there's this piece of those of us who've been here, who came as young adults, if you will, and wanting to stay connected to the continent, but perhaps not being able to move there for different reasons. And so we manifest, we wear our Africanness on our bodies, in our work, in the music we choose to produce or we produce. And so I think I'm skirting your question a little bit about,
no, it's okay.
about
it's okay.
the African-American connection and peace. But I think that there's a lot of conversation to be had around that piece, because there is still, there's a difference, I think, well, I'll speak for myself. I don't identify as African-American because there's a different history, there's a different experience, even though I am an African with U.S. citizenship. I think that there's also a little bit of tension to be teased out. Very much so, I think there's a sense sometimes of African immigrants, particularly from a certain economic background or education background, being privileged in the U.S. because we speak a certain way, because we're the good black people. I have had someone say to me, well, you're not one of them. And at the time, I was still new to the U.S. and didn't quite get what this person was saying to me. In retrospect, I'm like, wow, that was crazy, actually. Because when I show up on the streets of Oakland or wherever I am, I'm a black person in America. It's only when I open my mouth that someone realizes, well, okay, wait, there's a difference here. And so there's a lot of tension, I think, to be teased out. There's a lot to really wrestle with, because as neo-diasporans, yes, we have this African heritage and culture that's still very recent. We're recent transplants from the continent, but we're showing up as black people in the U.S.
We'll get you. We'll get you back. We'll get you back for another half-hour conversation on neo-diaspora, and we can think about it and talk about it. We've been joined, our pleasure, by Rufaro Gawada. She is a new network coordinator of Priority Africa Network, located at 6501 Telegraph Avenue. You can go on their line, priorityafrica.org. You can volunteer. You can donate. There's an event coming up tomorrow, and we expect great things from you, Rafal. We're looking forward to that, okay?
Thank you so much for having me.
Total pleasure.
Bismillah. Salamu alaikum, Africa.